The goal of this series of lectures is to study the development of the American modern Orthodox rabbinate over the course of the 20th century. In this first lecture, I'm going to focus on the period from approximately 1900 to 1950, and the title of the lecture is Affiliation Without Observance, the Challenge of American Orthodoxy from 1900 to 1950. And our central question is deceptively simple, but fundamentally important. What kind of Orthodox community were American rabbis leading, and how did they respond to it? Very often, when we think about Orthodoxy, we imagine a community defined by observance, by halachic commitment, by clear standards, and by continuity with the past. Whatever the halacha says we're supposed to do, that is what the community did. When we turn to early 20th century America, we encounter a very different reality. We find a world in which affiliation did not necessarily mean observance. Understanding that gap between identity and behavior is the key to understanding everything about the American Orthodox rabbinate in this period. To understand the rabbinate, we need to begin with the environment in which it operated. In Europe, Jewish communal life was structured, centralized, and hierarchical. A city often had a recognized rabbinic authority. The Kehila functioned as the governing body. Religious life was not optional. It was embedded in the social and legal fabric of Jewish existence. America was fundamentally different. Because of the separation of church and state and a culture of religious freedom, Judaism became voluntary. There was no central authority, no enforcement mechanism, and no binding communal structure. This produced a dramatic shift from a community of a synagogue, or shall we say from a synagogue community to a community of synagogues. It wasn't anymore a one synagogue in the community that was central to everyone and everyone belonged to the synagogue. Now a city had many different, or a community had many different synagogues. There was a shift from authority to competition. There was a shift from obligation to choice. Attempts to create a unified American Judaism in the 19th century by figures such as Rabbi Isaac Leiser, Rabbi Isaac Meir Wise, traditional rabbi and a traditional minister and a reform rabbi, ultimately failed. The emergence of Reform Judaism and later Conservative Judaism ensured that American Jewry would develop as a denominational spectrum rather than a unified communal structure. As a result, Orthodoxy was no longer the default position. It now had to compete for survival, legitimacy, and relevance within a voluntary religious marketplace. This structural shift coincided with a massive demographic transformation. Between 1881 and 1914, approximately 2 million East European Jews arrived in the United States. These immigrants brought strong religious traditions with them, but they entered a society that made religious change not only possible, but often necessary. Within this immigrant population, we can identify three broad types. First, you had the pious traditionalists. These were learned, observant Jews who attempted to transplant European Orthodoxy into America. Many accepted lower-paying jobs in order to maintain Shabbos observance, often working as malamdim or in Jewish communal roles. Yet even among them, there was an awareness of rupture. Many did not expect their American-born children to maintain the same level of observance. Second category is the Schwitzer, the upwardly mobile striver. These immigrants came primarily for economic advancement. Many gradually abandoned religious observance, seeing America as a space for opportunity and social mobility. Some even intermarried. And the third group was the ideological radical. These were free thinkers, socialists, and revolutionaries who arrived with a vision of transforming society and often rejected traditional religion entirely. Of course, most immigrants did not fit neatly into a single category. Rather, they constantly negotiated between tradition, economic survival, and modern ideology. The result was not continuity, and it was not collapse. It was fragmentation. And Orthodoxy in America became a negotiation rather than an inheritance. By the early 20th century, a striking pattern had emerged. Large numbers of Jews identified as Orthodox but did not fully observe halacha. There are many vivid illustrations of this phenomenon. The journalist Hutchins Hapgood describes Orthodox Jews in in an article called The Spirit of the Ghetto, Studies of the Immigrant Quarter of New York, and he writes, "The Orthodox Jews go to the theater on Friday night, the beginning of the Sabbath, are commonly somewhat ashamed of themselves and try to quiet their consciences by a vociferous condemnation of the actors on the stage. The actor, who through the exigencies of his role is compelled to appear on Friday night with a cigar in his mouth, is frequently greeted with hisses and strenuous cries of shame, shame, smoke on the Sabbath from the proletarian hypocrites in the gallery." So in this piece, in this passage, so Hapgood describes these Orthodox Jews attending theater on Friday night. You may assume that they purchased tickets in advance, but what's clear is that they are going to the theater, and the actors presumably are Jewish and Orthodox, and some of them have a cigar, and the audience, made up of Orthodox Jews, feel that the actors are being mechal al Shabbos because they have a cigar. But the broader point of this passage, I think, becomes clear. Identity and behavior were no longer aligned. Just because they were Orthodox, identified as Orthodox, they may not have been fully observant, certainly when it comes to Shabbos. Many synagogue members worked on Shabbos. One historian noted that by 1906, 91% of Russian Jewish immigrants were no longer strictly Orthodox in practice. Now, these figures may be exaggerated, but still reflect a serious decline in observance. Kashrus observance was inconsistent. Synagogue attendance was often limited to high holidays. Even within Orthodox institutions themselves, boundaries were shifting. Mixed seating appears, choirs, later microphones were introduced, and halachic standards were inconsistently enforced. Orthodoxy in this period functioned less as a system of law and more as a communal identity, a marker of continuity, and a framework for belonging. And the gap between identity and practice was not accidental. It was structurally driven. Number one, there was economic pressure. Keeping Shabbos often meant losing one's job. Many Shabbos violators were not rejecting Judaism. They were trying to survive economically. Number two, voluntarism. In America, no external authority could enforce observance. Religion became a matter of personal choice. Number three, there was weak rabbinic infrastructure. There were relatively few highly trained rabbis, and those who did serve were financially dependent on their congregations. And number four, cultural integration. Participation in the American social economic life often came at the cost of traditional observance. The result was a community that was Orthodox in identity, but not fully in practice. So herein lies the rabbinic challenge. This creates a profound dilemma. How do you lead a community that identifies as Orthodox, but does not behave accordingly? The European model no longer functioned. The American rabbi could not command, he could not enforce, he could not assume compliance, therefore he had to persuade, inspire, and retain. And just to provide an example of the shift between the European model and the rabbinic model, I will briefly discuss the failed experiment of Rav Yaakov Yosef. There was an attempt to import the European style authority through Rav Yaakov Yosef as the chief rabbi. In 1887, American Orthodox congregations, modeled in part after the chief rabbinate of Great Britain, attempted to establish a centralized chief rabbinate to be modeled in part after the chief rabbinate of Great Britain. And the goal of this chief rabbi would be to oversee Jewish life, particularly in kosher supervision. They raised funds, formed a governing board led by a powerful Orthodox shul, Beth HaMidrash HaGadol, and they reached out to leading European rabbis such as Rav Yisrael Chanan Spector of Israel Hildesheimer and Rav Yaakov Yosef, among others. However, even before this association of American congregations saw a need for a chief rabbi, the Gedolim in Eastern Europe also saw the need for stronger rabbinic leadership in America. Rav Yaakov Halevi Lipschitz, the secretary of Yisrael Chanan Spector, wrote in 1887 the following. He said, for some years now, many leading rabbis who are greatly concerned with the welfare of their people and the Torah have turned their attention to their brethren in America. Since the material and spiritual lives of American Israel are so intertwined with our brethren here, in matters of aid and support, in matters of family purity, marriage, and divorce, which are officiated over by improper men in matters of kashrus, to deal with these problems, the leading rabbis held three conferences 2 years ago in Tel Shai and Ponovich to seek ways and means of elevating the Jewish religious life in America. So this passage clearly demonstrates this was not only a concern of the American Orthodox Jewish community, but also the leadership, the rabbinic leadership in Eastern Europe. So again, invitations went out to a number of rabbonim in Eastern Europe in order to take on the position of chief rabbi. Many candidates hesitated, questioning whether American congregations were unified enough to sustain such a position. Although Rabbi Hillel Lipschitz was initially selected, he deferred under pressure from European rabbinic leaders. They all decided to back out and lend their support to Rav Tzvi Hirsch Spector, the son of Rav Yisachon Spector. And they basically said, we've decided that we will give you Rav Tzvi Hirsch Spector as the chief rabbi of America. Yet the American community ultimately rejected this direction, because they thought that European models of authority and the type of rabbinic figure they produce might not succeed in the American environment. Sort of like if Reitz, Reitz, who provides, or the rabbinic placement office of Reitz, tells a suburban Orthodox community, I will pick for you who your rabbi will be. And the suburban Orthodox community will say, no, you can maybe provide candidates, but we're picking. Here the Gedolim in Europe basically got together and said, we want Rav Tzvi Hirsch Spector to be the chief rabbi in America. And America said, sorry, no thanks. So this episode revealed both a desire for central authority and an emerging awareness that American Jewish life required a different leadership model, one in which European rabbinic influence no longer carried decisive weight for American lay leadership. American lay leaders were going to decide who the chief rabbi would be. And Rav Yaakov Yosef, a respected scholar and darshan from Vilna, was ultimately brought to New York in 1888. Initially, expectations were high. His primary mission was to regulate kashrus. In fact, I have a quote here from, he wrote a letter, the follow, where he says, herewith I make known to all of our brethren, children of Israel, who tremble at the word of the Lord, that inspectors have already been appointed in the poultry slaughterhouses to test the knives and to have supervision of everything in their care. From this day forward, every bird slaughtered in the abattoir under our supervision will be stamped with a plumba, a lead seal. On the plumba will be the words, Harav Akola Rav Yaakov Yosef. And we will make it known to you that if you find any butcher's chicken not so stamped, that it was not killed under our supervision, we cannot guarantee it to be kosher. May those who hearken to our words prosper and share in the heavenly blessing. On the third day of the Sidra HaBeracha, 5649, which is September 18th, 1888, says Jacob Joseph, chief rabbi of New York. So this refers to the fact that the lay leadership under this association that hired him said that to fund his work, a tax would be imposed on kosher chicken, and this will help, you know, fund his employment. However, this triggered an immediate backlash. Housewives who bought the chickens resented the increased cost. Butchers resisted regulation. Other rabbis opposed the system, since it threatened their own source of income, because basically there was an existing system of kashrus, and he was basically saying, when it comes to chicken was more expensive than meat, so they didn't tax the meat, but they said for chicken, the hashgacha is only good if it's by Rabbi Yaakov Yosef. So people who are already giving hashgacha, and so he was taking away their livelihood. Butchers who basically he was saying that maybe your chickens need the kashrus needs other procedures. They were very upset at him, and in fact, The tax was labeled Korobka, evoking oppressive taxation in Tsarist Russia, meaning that in the Tsarist Russia, where a lot of these Jews came from, when there was a Jew tax, it was called the Korobka. Now they're saying that this extra tax of one penny on each chicken to fund for kosher supervision was akin to this taxation in Tsarist Russia, and it made this symbolically toxic. Rival factions quickly emerged. There was a bunch of synagogues that supported another, a rival chief rabbi. Competing authorities developed, financial support collapsed. Rav Yaakov Yosef died, broken, and this experiment of a chief rabbi failed. But the failure itself was instructive. It demonstrated that European-style centralized rabbinic authority was structurally incompatible with American Jewish life. So what did American Orthodox rabbis do? They responded not by restoring authority, but by adapting to reality. They made a strategic choice. Better partial observance than total disengagement. This meant tolerating non-observance within limits, avoiding alienating congregants, prioritizing Jewish continuity over strict enforcement. For example, Jonathan Sarna writes about something that Rabbi Oscar Fassman did. Rabbi Oscar Fassman was an American Orthodox communal leader, best known for his role in building Orthodox institutions in Chicago and Skokie. And he developed an innovative program, such as Friday night forums designed to engage congregants even when they were not fully observant. This is how the Jewish historian Jonathan Sarna describes it. He writes that in 1944, Rabbi Oscar Fassman made the case for the Friday night forum in a guide to practical synagogue problems at the Orthodox Union Commission. It offered a roadmap for reaching potential attendees without abridging the tradition. It was made clear to him that the Orthodox synagogue had to offer an attractive way to mark the Sabbath in a religious way. Otherwise, the only contact that the old-timers would have with the congregation would be what he called the three Y's: Yom Tov holidays, probably the high holidays, Yisker, and Yahrzeit. As far as the young people were concerned, it was evident to him that if their congregations were non-responsive, the impressionable will casually or habitually end up in competitive, conservative, or even reformed congregations. That is, if they attended any synagogue. The trick for Fassman was to tweak the Orthodox tradition, ordaining devotions that stopped short of constituting a formal evening service. Those prayers would be recited at the proper time by whoever appeared at sundown. For example, besides the rabbi's formal address and zmirot led by a good cantor, perhaps even with a men's choir, a series of responsive readings in English would be offered, designed to provide religious nourishment for those who are not completely at home in the traditional Hebrew service. The evening would be capped off with a social hour. This is beautiful. So when people go to work, they want to go out Friday night. They go out, they hear a nice lecture by the rabbi, and they hear a beautiful choir. They hear some singing. There'd be some responsive readings, and it would be very suitable for them. Again, it wouldn't be a traditional Friday night davening. It would be later on in the evening as well. It wouldn't be at sundown. And it would be a social hour. They'd have some food as well, a beautiful night out. So this was a rabbinic response to adapt to Jews who were affiliated with an Orthodox shul, but not necessarily so Shabbos observant, halachically Shabbos observant. In many cases, rabbis trained at Orthodox seminaries such as Reitz in New York and the Hebrew Theological College in Chicago accepted pulpits and mixed seating congregations, particularly in emerging suburban communities in the 1950s. Although Orthodox leadership opposed such arrangements, rabbis increasingly faced pressure to accommodate American Jewish expectations, which often viewed separate seating as outdated. The rabbi's role was transformed. Instead of functioning primarily as an authority figure, he became a speaker, a teacher, a relationship builder. Rabbi Moshe Weinberger, who was a leading rabbinic figure of this period, wrote in Darosh Darash the following, quote, "The crown is lifted and the wreath removed from the heads of the rabbis in our times. Their edicts are no longer edicts, and their decrees are no longer decrees. And the nullification of rabbinical legal prerogative by the governmental authority leaves them with only the sermon, However, in most places, the sermon is also in danger, for orations which are not commodious and properly arranged and adapted to the spirit of the times and to the spiritual taste of the public will do no good, for even the sermon, once under the sole and exclusive power of the rabbis, is now under the power of the congregation, end quote. Rabbi Moshe Weinberger argued that even the sermon itself had to adapt. That's what he was singing around himself, that's happening to Rabbanim. Sermons became more accessible, and they were usually delivered in English. They frequently included humor and references to everyday life and current events. In Eastern Europe, and sermons were rare and highly scholarly, primarily serving to demonstrate rabbinic mastery and authority of a particular topic. In America, by contrast, sermons became a regular feature of synagogue life and functioned as a weekly tool of engagement. This reflected a deeper transformation. The rabbi was no longer only a judge or legal authority, but increasingly a communicator who had to persuade and connect with his audience. Menachem Blondheim, a professor at Hebrew University, argues that the American Orthodox sermon became a key cultural mechanism through which immigrant Jews adjusted to life in the United States. In his essay, Divine Comedy, he shows how it reflects a shift from European rabbinic authority rooted in obligation and hierarchy to a modern audience-centered model shaped by voluntary participation and competition. Because American Jews could choose whether to attend synagogue, rabbis had to make sermons engaging and relevant. As a result, sermons became shorter, simpler, and more focused on practical moral instruction rather than complex textual analysis. Humor played a particularly important role. It helped attract audiences, but also allowed rabbis to navigate tensions between tradition and modernity, offering critique of both American society and traditional Jewish life without fully rejecting either. Ultimately, the sermon became both a religious message and a mechanism of social adaptation. One of the earliest examples of this emerging American Orthodox model was Rabbi Bernard Drachman. Drachman was born in New York in 1861 and raised in Jersey City. He studied at Columbia College and initially prepared for the rabbinate at Temple Emmanuel Theological Seminary, intending to pursue advanced training in Berlin under the Reform rabbinic tradition associated with Abraham Geiger. However, once in Europe, he shifted direction and enrolled at the Jewish Theological Seminar in Breslau, associated with Zachariah Frankel's Historical School. There he received Orthodox-leaning rabbinic ordination and also earned a PhD from the University of Heidelberg, combining traditional rabbinic credentials with modern academic training. Drachman returned to the United States in 1885 and became rabbi of Ohev Shalom in Newark, New Jersey. His tenure ended when the congregation voted over his objections to introduce mixed seating, leading to his resignation. He later reflected that there was no room, no demand in America for an American-born English-speaking rabbi who insisted on maintaining the laws and usages of traditional Judaism. At this early stage of American Jewish life, Orthodoxy lacked institutional strength, and many congregations either leaned Reform or preferred European-trained rabbis whose authority was rooted in immigrant Yiddish-speaking culture rather than American-born leadership. In 1889, Drachman became rabbi of a congregation in Yorkville, Manhattan, where he found a community more receptive to his vision of Orthodoxy adapted to American society. He became a key figure in shaping early modern Orthodoxy and played a central role in the ideological development of the Orthodox Union, promoting English sermons, cultural engagement, and synagogue life that could appeal to American-born Jews while remaining halakhically committed. He later served as dean and professor at the Jewish Theological Seminary during its early years, when it still maintained an Orthodox orientation. Over time, Drachman came to represent a transitional figure bridging European rabbinic scholarship and emerging American Orthodox communal life, and he influenced later leaders such as Bernard Revel in addressing the challenges of Jewish continuity in America. At some point in the second half of the 20th century, modern Orthodox rabbis began to assert themselves more directly and to promote greater observance among their adherents. The seeds of this shift, however, were already planted in the first half of the century through two major developments. First is Rietz and the vision of Rabbi Bernard Dov Revel. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, Jewish education in America was underdeveloped and often inadequate for transmitting strong religious commitment. Institutions like Machzikei Talmud Torah, founded in 1883, initially stood alone in serving Eastern European immigrants, offering afternoon instruction at minimal cost. By 1910, Talmud Torah enrollment in New York had expanded significantly, serving over 10,000 students. Yet these schools remained supplementary and often focused on basic literacy and bar mitzvah preparation. At the same time, many children attended poorly run traditional cheders, often in unsanitary conditions and led by unqualified teachers, which left many alienated from Jewish learning. Serious Talmud study was largely unavailable until institutions like Eitz Chaim Yeshiva began integrating traditional learning with basic secular education. In response, more structured institutions emerged, most notably the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary, Reitz, founded in 1897 with support from Agudat HaRabbanim. Initially, Reitz focused on advanced Talmud study with little emphasis on professional rabbinic training or secular studies. However, internal tension soon emerged as students demanded broader education and rabbinic preparation for American life. These tensions led to institutional instability until Rabbi Bernard Revel assumed leadership after 1915. Revel recognized Reitz around the principle of translation, not transplantation. He integrated secular studies, established Yeshiva High School, and eventually developed Yeshiva College. His vision produced a new generation of American Orthodox rabbis and lay leaders, despite opposition from more traditional elements who feared cultural dilution. Ultimately, his model laid the foundation for modern Orthodoxy. Under Revel, a new model emerged. He built a Yeshiva High School, a college, and a seminary. His vision emphasized Torah and secular education, engagement with modernity, and training American rabbis for an American environment. This framework became the foundation of modern Orthodoxy. The arrival of Soloveitchik at Reitz in 1941, of Rav Yoshe Ber Soloveitchik, Joseph B. Soloveitchik, in 1941 marked a major intellectual milestone, but the institutional groundwork had already been laid by Rabbi Revel in the first half of the 20th century. The second factor which led, which we see the seeds of a change in the modern Orthodox rabbin in the second half of the 20th century, we see the seeds being planted in the first half, and this has to do with Orthodoxy and conservative Judaism. In this period, the first half of the 20th century, Orthodoxy and conservative Judaism were deeply entwined. There was shared membership, shared institutions, overlapping rabbis. And in fact, one prominent Sephardic American rabbi and scholar, Rabbi David de Solapool, he said the following in 1942. He said, "Today it is growing increasingly difficult to discern any essential organic difference between Orthodoxy and conservatism. The main differentiae seem to be that conservative synagogues permit men and women to sit together and make more use of English in the services than do most Orthodox synagogues. Some Orthodox synagogues use some English and seat the sexes, if not together, at least on one floor. No logical or clear line can be drawn today between the movement, as American Orthodoxy no longer mirrors East European life. Innovations like the late Friday night evening service, or the removal of the women's gallery, or the confirmation of girls, or a community seder would have shocked the worshippers of a generation ago, today are accepted in numerous congregations. Even attempts were made to merge JTS and Yeshiva College. During the interwar period, several American synagogues, such as the Brooklyn Jewish Center and Congregation, Adas Israel in Cincinnati, were seen by their members as occupying an ambitious space between conservative and Orthodox Judaism. This reflected broader fluidity in denominational identity, where boundaries had not yet fully solidified. And as mentioned, at the same, there was pressure. There were attempts made to merge JTS and Yeshiva College, because at this time, in the 1920s, both JTS and Yeshiva College faced financial pressures, and these pressures led to a serious, though ultimately unsuccessful, attempt in 1926 to merge these two institutions. On the surface, the proposal appeared practical: two struggling institutions with overlapping constituencies and similar communal goals. However, while JTS leadership supported the idea, and some yeshiva lay leaders were open to it, right, Bernard Revel and his allies in the Agudas HaRabbanim, a more right-wing rabbinic organization, strongly opposed the merger. They argued that the institutions reflected fundamentally different religious and educational philosophies. In their view, JTS emphasized rabbinic training with less intensive focus on traditional Talmud and Halacha, While Yeshiva College prioritized deep Talmudic study and a broader Orthodox educational vision, including education for laypeople, these differences were not merely technical. They reflected competing visions of Jewish continuity in America. This ideological divide was further sharpened by concerns over faculty such as Mordechai Kaplan at JTS, whose theological positions increasingly fell outside traditional Orthodox categories, further widening the gap. Although the merger ultimately failed, significant overlap remained. Many JTS ordainees had studied at yeshiva, and a large proportion of JTS students still came from Orthodox backgrounds well into mid-20th century. Institutional separation did not immediately eliminate social or educational continuity. The conservative movement initially sought to remain within the traditional fold, presenting itself not as a break from Orthodoxy, but as a moderated continuation of it. Over time, however, it developed its own distinct identity. Michael Cohen's analysis in The Birth of Conservative Judaism highlights that early conservative Judaism lacked a sharply defined ideology. Under Solomon Schachter, it was conceived as a broad tent grounded in historical Judaism and the principle of Catholic Israel, which held that legitimate religious change required evolving communal consensus. And Schachter's charismatic leadership fostered loyalty and unity, but not doctrinal clarity. The movement emphasized continuity over innovation, and conservative synagogues were often distinguished from Orthodox ones more by cultural style, English sermons, decorum, and modern educational methods than by halachic difference. This restraint had major institutional consequences. The movement avoided issuing authoritative prayer books, halachic rulings, or practical guides to observance in order to preserve internal unity. Any premature standardization risked fragmentation. As a result, substantial overlap persisted between the Orthodox Union and the United Synagogue, which was the organization of the conservative movement. Rabbis often competed for the same pulpits. Orthodox rabbis served in mixed seating congregations, and many synagogues later identified as conservative originally described themselves as modern Orthodox. At the same time, Orthodox unease grew. Agudas HaRabbonim rejected United Synagogue congregations, accusing conservative Judaism of tolerating halachic deviation without formal acknowledgement. Tensions intensified in cases such as Louis Epstein's 1935 proposal regarding Agunot from the conservative movement, where Orthodox rejection and conservative hesitation revealed deepening discomfort with this kind of halachic change. Still, no immediate clean break emerged. One defining feature of this period was lingering ambiguity, since conservative Judaism had not yet fully crystallized into a clearly bounded ideology. Only in the second half of the 20th century, when conservative Judaism asserted clear ideological independence, did modern Orthodoxy itself begin to define and assert its own boundaries more sharply. A key conclusion from this lecture emerges. These rabbis of the first half of the 20th century were not revolutionaries. They were mediators. They interpreted change, they managed adaptation, and they preserved continuity. They did not create Americanization, they responded to it. By mid-century, American Orthodoxy stood on a paradox. There was broad affiliation, weak observance, strong institutions, and limited authority by the rabbis. But the eventual separation from conservative Judaism, combined with the strengthening of Yeshiva University under figures like Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, would radically reshape the modern Orthodox rabbinate in the second half of the 20th century.